Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's program was brought to you by Patina Events at Brooklyn Botanic Garden, an idyllic location for weddings, corporate events, and parties of any style. Visit us at patinaevents.com.
This week on Meat and Three, we're getting semantic to understand the deeper meaning behind some of the foods we love. First, we'll look at the big debate happening around the word milk.
Who the hell are you to tell me what is the name of my product and my landscape and everything we've cared about when, you know, you don't have anything invested in except to put out a little money to buy it? It's our entire life.
Then we get the lowdown on the language of cider.
So the first thing that's really confusing about dryness is that it has nothing to do with how something actually feels in your mouth.
And finally, we get our fill of tiki talk.
You don't walk into a tiki bar and be like, oh yeah, this is what Polynesia is probably like. Like, it's supposed to be like fantasy and stuff. That's the hard part. It's so easy to do tiki bad, and that's where it gets a bad name.
Tune into this week's episode of Meat and Three. That's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to Food Without Borders, a show about food, politics, and identity. I'm your host, Sari Kamen, and you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org. My guest today is Mohammed Moderis. He's a current 2019 TED resident and the founder of Abe's Meats, which is an award-winning social impact organization that has produced the first ever interfaith meat products that are both halal and kosher. The product has premiered at Shabbat Salam interfaith dinners around the country, from San Francisco to New York's Times Square. Welcome to the show, Mohammed.
Thanks for having me, Sarah.
Thank you so much for joining us. You have so many amazing different things that you are working on that I know are all connected, and I hope we can touch on most of them today. But why don't you start by just telling us a little bit about like where you're from and what your upbringing was like, because I know part of your story has very much sort of informed your business.
Sure, absolutely. I grew up not too far away in a place called Paramus, New Jersey, just the suburbs of New York.
Famous for IKEA
and just many other malls. It's actually the mecca of shopping. A lot of New Yorkers go to Paramus to go to Garden State Plaza and Paramus Park, and all the Paramus residents at one point or another have folded shirts at Banana Republic. Like, that's just
did you?
That's how we all bond. Absolutely. Yeah, I was in room one, the intro where you know you'd greet and you know you'd make sure that they would follow through to room two and room three, and if you know if they're big spenders, hopefully they get a suit. And everybody's all happy.
Yeah.
But spent some time in Paramus, New Jersey before I went on to study public health at Hopkins. And I got my first taste of doing some public health work abroad in Southern and Eastern Africa, where I was introduced to different aspects of public health, mostly in environmental science, before I got a phone call to come to California, which was always the light at the end of the tunnel. I always thought I would end up in California. So I was really excited to go there and to work under a renewable energy company and then go into biotechnology before the 2016 elections happened. And the rhetoric, the atmosphere really changed, and it really reminded me of actually what my family and a lot of different minority groups felt after 2001, after September 11th.
And where's your family from?
We're Iranian background, Muslim Americans. And I never thought that I would then transition to food, not at all. I mean, if you were to ask my parents. But after the 2016 elections, and seeing witnessing the rise in anti-Semitism, the rise in anti-Muslim bigotry, I wanted to just bring my Muslim and Jewish friends together and over dinner, talk about how we could combat this rise in hate. And sure enough, we couldn't necessarily agree on the food. We needed to have, of course, kosher food, halal food. I wanted to respect, as the host, I wanted to respect everyone's religious dietary laws and make sure that I would be as inclusive as possible. And sure enough, I thought, well, this is, you know, this is odd. I grew up eating halal food. My parents continue to be consume halal food only in the household. And I never really thought about the difference between halal and kosher. And so sure enough, I decided to just jump into my van. Living in California, I was very stereotypical. I had a 1979 VW bus, one of those surfer buses. And I started just going up and down the coast and asking people, you know, religious leaders, food experts, if I could combine this process, this halal and kosher process. And the hardest part of it is in meat, especially if you're talking about gluk kosher, which is a more orthodox form of kosher, sabiha halal, which is a more conservative form of halal. And sure enough, I found people who just were really into the idea as much as I was, as excited as I was. And I mean, I became really obsessed with it after a couple of months of just, you know, running around and getting deeper and deeper into the supply chain of just meat production, but just general food production as well. I'd like to think that if you, I have this, I feel like, common trait with other people who study public health, we just are constantly digging deeper and deeper into how things are made. And with food, I mean, it is just endless, especially in meat production. There's just so many different stories and different ways of production. Some, as we know, that are extremely bad for the environment, and other ways that are that can be very good for the environment.
Before we get too deep into that, which is such an interesting part of component of your business model, I'm just curious, like, how, because you didn't work in food at all, like, how it even occurred to you that, like, food was this way in, you know, like, what even inspired you to start bringing your friends together, like, through food? How did that become, like, an access point for you?
Absolutely. So before then, a little side note, I should say, I was, my dissertation actually in public health was about using sports as a tool to educate youth around different health issues. And so I had already, based on sports and prior to that, based on art, I was a political cartoonist.
You look very young to me. You like lived nine lives and had 37 careers.
But it's just, it's almost like in the autobiography of Malcolm X, you know, there's a part in the book, and of course a part in the movie, where Malcolm X is given two glasses of water, and one is a clear glass of water, and the other is droplets of ink. And the person speaking to him says, "Look, you could tell someone that water is dirty, or you could let them see for themselves, and you could let them explore." And a lot of times, when I see different forms of management and leadership, there are a lot of people who will point at something and say, that's bad and that's good. And it doesn't allow people to take ownership of that experience. While as if you use a tool to take people through that experience and then allow them to take ownership of it by themselves, they have a much more transformative approach to it all. And so whether that's food, whether that's sports, whether that's the arts, and mind you, with the arts, a lot of my illustrations, a lot of my artwork was against war. You know, I was doing a lot of illustrations at the time of the Iraq War. The Abu Ghraib prison scandal was a piece that I did. That was kind of controversial, but it allowed me to speak to an audience without saying much. Sports, for example, I was working with FIFA's Football for Hope program. This was for the 2010 FIFA World Cup in South Africa. And instead of telling kids, you know, 7, 8, you know, 10, 15 years old, who have had parents who lost parents because of HIV AIDS, you know, this is what HIV is, this is what AIDS is. Rather, we take the game of football and we teach it to them in a very different way. We, you know, the goalie is the condom, the soccer ball is the virus, and it allows them to then be able to narrate their own process and begin to learn about something that they otherwise would see as so distant to them. And so in the case of food, what ends up being so beautiful is that when you can tell people that, hey, we've combined the halal and kosher process in meat specifically, because that's the hardest, our attendees, in this case at the Shabbat Salam events, are enamored by the fact that, wait, if we can bring this together, what else can we merge? And it ends up not really being about the meat, but rather as a tool to talk about how we can collaborate in different ways and make sure that we're working together to tackle this rise in hate. Now, for the Jewish person, of course, they've been dealt with anti-Semitism. For the Muslim, that's anti-Muslim bigotry. But for the most part, it's very much the same thing. And that is when people are unfortunately put in a situation to believe in the other hurting them, the other taking away their job, the other, you know, what have you. It's just a form of dehumanizing someone. And in our situation, we've realized that when the Muslim and with their Jewish equivalent coming together, not only for producing the meat, but coming together to build an agenda to tackle this, they also create a much stronger movement. And that's now unfolded so much beyond Abe's Meats. I mean, for us, it first started off as just, let's host these Shabbat Salam dinners, let's see what happens. Then after we had about 1,000 people come to these dinners, these attendees came up to us and were just like, hey, can we buy the meat? You know, we want to share it in our communities. And that's when Abe's Meats was formed. I mean, I generally didn't think I would, be establishing a food company by any means. To my parents, dismay of they're still waiting for me to get a real job, right?
Sure.
So
yeah.
But that said, it's really taken a world of its own, and we just have incredible support, an incredible family of not just religious leaders but food experts who want to showcase it and be part of making sure that, we have this conversation of representation or movie screens, representation or in our political leaders. But now it's about also having representation in the simplest things. And that even means the dinner table, making sure that our guests, our neighbors, when they come over, we are as inclusive as possible. And for the longest time, that actually meant for Muslims and Jews, that's the dilemma of kosher and halal. For others, that may be gluten-free and other dietary restrictions.
I don't think that Muslims and Jews have a lot of opportunities to sit down together for dinner, unless there's like something is cultivated for that to happen. But it seems like from where your perspective, like you had, like you're Muslim and you also had a lot of Jewish friends, like you were sort of uniquely positioned to think about like this really cohesive future opportunity, where like that could happen more frequently and, you know, in different settings. And I think, you know, things have been created like since Trump's election where there's people thinking about how to get people sitting together at a table and break down some of these barriers. And like food is certainly a great way to create a context for that. How were you able to see that? I mean, how were you sort of like, what was your launching off point where you were like, what's happened with this election is affecting me and my community and like my family, but it's also affecting other people? Because I don't think people step outside themselves very often to think about like the larger picture, if that makes sense.
Sure. I mean, I'm not going to give Trump too much credit here.
Certainly.
It's been, I'll say this, being Iranian American, having lived in Iran, nuance was always part of just our household. You know, we would not necessarily agree with, but we would very much respect opinions of another person. And we would have, I mean, I grew up watching 60 Minutes and you know, Intelligence Squared with my parents. And living in Iran was also an incredible opportunity to just learn, specifically in Iran, Isfahan, a town that has a very large Jewish population, Muslim population, Armenian Christian population. There's a beautiful Armenian Christian church we would pass through every week as we would go to the park. And it was actually until I came to the United States where I realized that, oh, okay, people seem to separate themselves because of their faith. That was just
right.
Fascinating to me. But I mean, that said, I think we are going in a lot of people say we're going in a, you know, dark direction and this and that. And of course you have instances that can make us believe that, right? A synagogue gets damaged. You know, the shooting in Pittsburgh, what happened in New Zealand recently. But between those points, I will say that there are communities that have been working together for hundreds of years, that, you know, the conversation of being a Muslim in America is not even a generation or two generations old. I mean, Thomas Jefferson and his Quran, that's as old as this country's history. I think it's a matter more of narrative and how we do storytelling. And the bigger question for me is always, you know, the TED conference is going on this week, and Jack Dorsey, the founder of Twitter, had a conversation with Chris Anderson, who's the CEO of TED. And there was a lot about how do we now control, or not control this narrative, but allow people to have freedom of speech, but at the same time be able to do fact-checking and be able to not see things as so black and white. And I think for us, those of us who, you know, are lucky enough to have the motivation and to have the drive and to kind of push ourselves through this, you know, as Elon Musk calls the eating glass moment, this painful process of whether that's entrepreneurship or activism or whatever that drives you, it's about making sure that we set out first and foremost creating a society that's built on truth. And you know, we value kindness and we value integrity and in many cases we value money, and you know, we value capitalism and we value materialism, and we've put aside truth for a little while because we have built an industry that, you know, a lot of people even say what bleeds reads. And it breaks my heart any time we have a situation such as Pittsburgh, such as New Zealand. But I also want people to know that there are countless of communities that are working together, that are building and rebuilding their communities to be stronger, to be inclusive, and inclusive across every aspect, right? Race and religion and what have you. I mean, just the other day, unfortunately, we had a place of worship, you know, the spire burn through, and in Paris, and few know that actually there was a fire, not of such great magnitude, but a fire that happened in Jerusalem, at a mosque that is very important to Muslims. And That narrative, and it happened actually, oddly enough, within 24 hours of each other. And so a lot of Muslims were talking about that, and a lot of, you know, Christians were talking about it. And he, you know, here's that moment, and I wish the I don't want to say media, I don't want to just generalize it to one group, but we need to have a conversation of making sure that our storytelling and this, even within that storytelling, that the truth of all this is constantly corrected and comes out. And I think about that a lot, and I still haven't, you know, it's a big problem, and there needs to be a big solution. And that solution, of course, involves technology. That solution will involve need to involve some form of regulation. I don't know. It's beyond my world right now. Maybe I'll have the luxury of hopping into that world soon. I don't know. But, you know, it's something that bothers me because there's just so much good work being done by a lot of people.
Yeah. Thank you for that. We're going to take a quick break and hear from our sponsor, and then we'll be right back.
Patina Restaurant Group offers unparalleled service in New York's most iconic locations, including Lincoln Center, Rockefeller Center, and Macy's Herald Square. Patina is also the exclusive caterer at Brooklyn Botanic Garden. From meetings and presentations in the glass-walled atrium, to galas in the renovated Palm House, and intimate wedding showers at Yellow Magnolia Cafe, your event will be perfectly imagined and customized at Brooklyn Botanic Garden. You can also enjoy a la carte brunch and lunch at the picturesque Yellow Magnolia Cafe overlooking Lilypool Terrace. Executive Chef Morgan Jarrett's unique menu offers warm, distinctive cuisine with a focus on local vegetables, grains, and sustainably sourced meats and fish.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Diane Stemple.
And I'm Elena Santigade, and we're the hosts of Cutting the Curd here on Heritage Radio Network. Featuring interviews with makers and mongers and everybody in between, this show is a downright funky look at the world of artisan cheese.
You can find Cutting the Curd wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, welcome back. You're listening to Food Without Borders on Heritage Radio. I'm your host, Sari Kamen, and I have been chatting with Mohammed Medaris. He's the founder of Abe's Meat, which is the first interfaith meat on the market. It's both halal and glatt kosher, which from my understanding is probably logistically very complicated and incredibly expensive to produce. and yet you do it.
It's expensive, that's for sure.
Do you want to just talk a little bit about like the logistics, like the behind the scenes
sure.
work to figure this all out and coordinate
sure.
it?
Yeah, you're gonna learn a lot about halal and kosher right now.
Good. Yeah, let's go.
So first of all, halal means permissible. Now, permissible can mean a lot of different things. In the halal world, that means something that is not haram or not permissible, which is not, you know, not alcohol, not swine or pork, you know, not cooking with vanilla extract, because that has a level of, you know, haram things in there. And so when people think about halal, it's actually like, yeah, you could go down the street, go to your, you know, local fried chicken joint, and that's actually halal because that's chicken. You can eat it. But what we say is zabiha halal. And zabiha halal, zabiha itself is the Arabic word for slaughter. And that is a relatively new concept by, you know, the culturally built to help people produce meat the right way. So for Muslims, that means, you know, offering a prayer, because at the end of the day, you're sacrificing another living sentient being to nourish yourself. And now many of the steps, some in the Middle East will disagree with some people in Malaysia or Singapore, right? So it's still a little controversial, if you will. I shouldn't say controversial, but you know, people go back and forth on different things. But for us, we have tried to take every single step into consideration and put it into our process. And so that means when we say we're Zabiha Halal, that means our sourcing is from livestock that are 100% grass-fed. That comes as local as from local ranchers, so New Jersey, Pennsylvania, et cetera. If we're, you know, as an East Coast company, that's, we source as local as possible. And then we also follow other types of dietary laws from different denominations of Islam. From the kosher standpoint, kosher means pure. And similar to halal, kosher itself is a little bit more broad, while as gluk kosher is a little bit more specific. It's a interpretation by a more orthodox form of Judaism. And similar to halal, the general concepts of halal and kosher can be found in religious texts, whether oral or written, while as the more specific gluk kosher and sabiha halal are fairly new. And so glut, the term glut itself, is referring to smooth, the smoothness of the lungs. So after a, what's called a Jewish shochet, the person who oversees the gluk kosher process, when they're sacrificing the animal, after that animal is then produced into meat, they check over the meat products themselves to see that it's, that the animal was a healthy animal. And so alongside the USDA official, because we work in a USDA facility, a shochet comes and says that, all right, you know, this animal is obviously grass-fed, grass-finished. You know, we see that within its stomach.
What does grass-finished mean?
So in the world of food, and coming from biotech, I found this so fascinating because I always thought that in healthcare, a lot of healthcare is just so much jargon, and it's so cloudy for the end patient to really understand what they're getting, especially the cost of our healthcare. That's a whole different story, whole different podcast. Yeah. But
luckily, but, not mine.
But in food, what I found so fascinating was that you could, as a consumer, want something, go and purchase that something, but not actually get what you're thinking of. And grass-fed is one of those terms, similar to free-range and pasture-raised and, natural and organic and all these terms. They have no actual, in the United States, no legal framework around it.
There's no specific guidelines.
Yeah, I mean, you can technically say, hey, this is organic, referring to so many products that for the end consumer they may be thinking something completely else, but you realizing that, hey, yeah, it's organic because, well, it, you know, it has carbon in it, and it's it's food, and with grass fed. There's a massive difference between, hey, this is grass-fed versus this is grass-fed, grass-finished, or another term for it, which makes it even more confusing, 100% grass-fed. So grass-fed literally means that an animal has had grass at some point. So, you know, spoiler alert, every animal has had grass at some point because they start off on grass. They start off on pasture. So you can have that same factory-farmed, grain-fed animal be labeled as grass-fed. That's heartbreaking. That's heartbreaking to so many consumers who are paying, they're, you know, just choosing, they're voting with their dollar to say, I want to buy something that's healthier. And so they go and look, and there it is. There's a label that says grass-fed, and they think they're getting something better. Meanwhile, it could be very much the same thing.
Oh, so it's like grass start to finish.
Yeah, and in this case, when we say grass-fed, grass-finish, that means from start to finish, the animal has lived on pasture and has, had a better life. It's a more ethical, more humane process. And one of the things that frustrated me the most about not just food production, but then going into religious dietary law is that, hey, you know, if you're going to call yourself kosher, if you're going to call yourself halal, if you're going to, you know, attach yourself to any other faith-based law, that you are then making yourself not accountable to necessarily a government, but accountable to God. And therefore, there's a certain level of responsibility that you're saying you're putting on yourself, and therefore your customers as trusting for you to have. And so when I see different companies that say they're following a certain dietary law and they're following they're producing factory farmed meat, that breaks my heart, you know. And a lot of times that's the same type of marketing as a company that says they're organic or they're 100% natural or what have you when they're not. So this is the type of, you know, in addition to being halal, in addition to being kosher, which those have their own expenses, it's about how do we produce a product that is of the highest quality. And for us, I was telling last time I was here was with Ethan.
On Y Foods.
On Y Foods, yeah, great guy. And we were chatting about how I'm a meat company now. I run a meat company, but I'm a meat company that doesn't necessarily want to be a meat company. I'm a meat company that wants you to eat less meat. I want you to eat less better meat. If you spend $20 a month, $50 a month, I don't know, $200 a month on meat products right now, well, take that same amount that you spend and make sure that you're getting it from a local source that does 100% grass-fed. And just by doing that, just taking your purchasing power and going local and going higher quality means you're going to eat less meat, which is better for the environment. And because of the fact that it's, you know, 100% grass-fed, it's even, you know, now you're even taking a further step into being more ecologically friendly. Because if it's done the right way, if you're consuming livestock that have been on pasture, that have, you know, grazed and poked and pooped on pasture, those animals are actually helping us build what's called carbon soil. So when manure is spread across pasture, that manure is actually extremely valuable. On pasture, what happens is this manure helps build a stronger soil, and that soil very much creates a stronger pasture that sequesters carbon. So we always think about trees as trees taking our CO2 in, trees being the lungs of the earth, and that's 100% true. But all the pastures across America, you know, in many ways, right? God bless them. You have so much pastures, so much pasture, and it could benefit so much in the fight against climate change, because these in a sense, grass can be straws that suck out carbon from the sky and put it back into our soil. And we have more carbon under our feet than all the plants and our atmosphere combined. There's a volcano underneath us. And we have to be very careful with how we take care of our grass and our soil and everything that is beneath us. And if we disrupt it, if we till and we factory farm, we are going to literally let this volcano erupt and cause us much more damage in our fight against climate change. So many people say, you know, eating meat is bad for the environment, and that is 100% true if it's factory farmed.
Right.
And unfortunately, 99% of the industry is factory farmed. But you have 1% of ranchers, 1% of farmers who are doing really good work in looking at regenerative agriculture. And so when you go out and you're thinking about buying your meat, chances are you have a lot of choices for factory farmed, which means you have to be very careful as a buyer, as a voter in this system. You are voting with your dollar to choose, you know, not only what tastes better, at least I'm biased to that, but what will add value to our farmer, to our economy, and to our environment.
On that note, and I know you have to wrap up, tell us then how we can find you, we didn't really get to talk too much about your Shabbat Salam dinners, which is best phrase I've ever heard. So brilliant. So if you can quickly kind of like give us the rundown of how to keep up with the dinners that you're doing. And I know that your meat is just available for purchase. Tell us about those things.
Yeah, sure. So we have Shabbat Salam dinners. We've had it around the country for over a year now, and it's been great. We've sold out every time. Thank you so much to everybody who shows up.
And to all the
always
future
last
people
minute
coming. Yeah. And to all the new people that are going to start coming.
But But now we actually just closed up our shop online, our e-commerce shop, because we're getting ready for a Kickstarter. And we just filmed our Kickstarter commercial. I don't want to give too much away, but on Sunday we filmed it. And over the next week, we're doing some post production. I'm super excited because like the first time I'm behind the camera, and I'm trying to act like a director or something. And my dad ended up coming from, my parents live in Portland now, and so my dad being here at the same time, kind of seeing all that type of stuff, seeing things unfold, because my parents are always wondering what's going on, right? What are you doing? So it's been nice, but hopefully when the Kickstarter campaign comes out, of course, I would love for everyone to check it out, to share it, to support us. We have, just like in everything, we have a wonderful, wonderful community. But then, of course, we always, every so often, have someone who, you know, doesn't like what we do. And we always want to make sure that even the person who doesn't, and this goes back to the conversation before commercial break, is it's embracing that nuance. And I learned this actually when I was in California. I lived in California for just a couple of years, but I ended up being in the same house as someone who, I was 25, 26 at the time, and she was about 72, 73 at the time. And for the elections, you know, I'm a big Bernie Sanders supporter. I will still continue to, for this elections, support him. And she was a Trump supporter. And every night we would have these wonderful conversations. And every night we would always make sure we ended it respectfully and understand the perspective that each of us is coming with. And so, you know, as a kind of unfold this initiative and bring Abe's Meats into the world, I still, you know, every so often deal with someone who says, because of, you know, whatever reason, that we don't produce good meat, or we're religiously, you know, this doesn't make sense. These two faiths can't come together, et cetera, et cetera. And, My only ask actually is of people is that if you meet someone who has this perspective, if you ever forward our stuff to them, if our Kickstarter is doing well, but there's a friend who otherwise is showing a little bit of hesitation for whatever reason, invite them to our Shabbat Salam, because what we want is people of vastly different views sitting across from each other. And this is the reason why I'm kind of still stuck in food. I thought, all right, you know, we'll do a couple of Shabbat Salams here and there, you know, see how it goes. Maybe we can get some people in different cities to host their own every so often. And I'll go back into public health, because it's just, I love public health. But sure enough, we're still around, and it's, you know, it comes down to the beauty of what the dinner table does. I mean, when you're sitting across from someone and the screens are, you know, put aside, you have the opportunity to really truly understand someone, because it's they're right there. They're in front of you. It's the information is as humanized as possible, right? It's not just a number anymore. It's not just an incident that you heard in the news. You get to see that person with all their emotion, with all their rawness. And so whenever, you know, we have someone who is different in the sense of just a different viewpoint, we want to make sure that they're there so they see what our community is so, you know, supportive of, and what our community, who is so supportive, understands and recognizes and respects the other viewpoints that are brought up. And to just give you an example, one of the issues that I would keep going back and forth with our my housemate at the time, she was saying that, you know, nothing is free, and it was in response to Bernie Sanders's thoughts about at the time making certain colleges or university level affordable and making it free. Considering what we're dealt with student loans and what have you. And her response was, hey, you know, nothing's free. Your generation is going to pay X much tax and all this, you know, you're going to, before you can blink your eyes, you're going to be paying 70, 80% tax. And, you know, I've lived in Europe for a while and I've paid my fair share of high taxes. And we went into a conversation of, well, what happens if we have a more educated society? Let's say people get their college degrees, more people can now afford it. So now more people are getting college degrees. Now that dilutes a little bit what the college degree may mean. But you have people who are, let's say, more critical thinkers. And now there's more people voting. So now we have a stronger democracy. So now we have people who are working more. And they're productive members of society. And depending on the community that you're working with, your home value can go up. And suddenly that seemed to trigger an interesting conversation for her. Because she was just like, oh, well, if my home price goes up, then what does that mean for my community? Because I want more parks and this and that. And it ended up being a very interesting learning lesson for myself and for her, realizing that the common ground is really about listening to just what the person wants within the community that they see as facing some type of challenge. And I think when we begin to have that conversations at our dinner tables and we give that moment, we allow people to be heard and we allow them to have more minds thinking together of solutions that can help our communities and hopefully our country and, you know, and hopefully that could go beyond borders. So I try to go 180 with the name.
We came full circle. I like it.
But yeah, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate being on.
Thank you so much for being here.
Episode.
And is abesmeets.com the best place to find
go
you?
Go on abesmeets.com. Sign up for...
Are you on Twitter? Are you on Instagram?
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. I already had just today's a couple Instagram followers. I like to think we're doing pretty good on Instagram content. We won't push it too hard, but you know, every time we'll post something, I think you'll like it. So thank
Keep
you so much.
Keep going with it. Thanks, Mohammed, and everyone out there. Make sure to check out his dinners and eat his meat. I think you'll like it. And best of luck with your Kickstarter. Make sure to kick in for that too. Thanks everyone for listening to Food Without Borders. This was the end of season 5. So thank you all for keeping up with us and following us on iTunes and Stitcher and Spotify and heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.